Can you tell us about Graham's reforms in 1832?
In 1830, Earl Grey forms the first post-war Whig administration on the mandate to institute major reform of British politics. The most famous bill, the Great Reform Act, changes the representation of the country, and it moves voting essentially across to the middle classes. The working classes are still largely excluded. This is not a popular measure with many parliamentarians, including the large number who generally supported the government of whatever colour. And to persuade them to vote these measures through, the Whigs did what they've been doing for decades, which is to promise lower taxes. So it's a lose your political power, but your taxes will go down. These are the twin poles of Grey's reforms. Much of the bill is written by Sir James Graham, who was then First Lord of the Admiralty, the political head of the Navy, which in those days was one of the great cabinet offices. Today we don't have a First Lord of the Admiralty, which may explain why the Navy isn't as well supported as it should be. Graham adopts a similarly radical approach to the Navy, because the Navy is one of the two great spending departments. In 1830, only two government departments spend any serious money, the Army and the Navy. Everything else is tiny. The Foreign Service is tiny. There are no pensions. There is no public support. All kinds of charity are run at a much lower level, far outside Parliament, much at a local level. So the only way to economise is to reduce the Army and the Navy. And given how important the Navy is to national security and to trade, the idea is not to reduce the seagoing Navy, but to reform its administration. Throughout the Napoleonic era, and for many years before, the Royal Navy had been administered in a slightly complex way. The Board of Admiralty, the political organisation that ran the Navy, was a very small body operating on Whitehall, which oversaw the interface between political and strategic need and naval operations. Essentially, when the Cabinet decided what was to be done, the Board of Admiralty then had it done. It did not administer the real estate of the Navy, dockyards. It didn't build or maintain the ships. It didn't hire or pay or feed the crew. That was done at Somerset House by the Navy Board, a much larger bureaucratic organisation that effectively oversaw the administration of this very large complex machine. Graham's reforms removed the Navy Board and placed the administrative organisation under the Board of Admiralty. So the naval lords of Admiralty, who had previously been there to think about strategy and policy, were now given the task of running a very large bureaucratic organisation. And as a result, they didn't have a lot of time to think about bigger issues like strategy and policy. So Graham's reforms essentially turned the Admiralty into a bureaucratic managerial position rather than a policy and strategy unit, which is what it needed to be. He was happy to do that because he himself thought that it was his job really to provide policy and strategy, although he knew relatively little about it. The reforms didn't work very well. They saved a lot of money, but the Navy's policy making was weakened. And this meant that over the next 10 years, the Navy's budget fell as successive governments found it expedient to cut the Navy to save money, because that was what the political process demanded. Anybody who studies modern politics will know that cutting defence estimates is always popular with everybody outside the defence establishment. And when it's as small as it is now, there are not many votes in the Navy. Queen Victoria's Navy in 1837 had roughly the same number of men in as the Navy has today. So this world-dominating organisation was actually quite small. The reforms were ultimately counterproductive. The Navy had to reorganise its administration and spent much of the 19th century trying to undo the problems that Graham had caused. And those problems never really went away. The root of them all is the political desire to control defence spending. And in 1827, the Duke of Wellington, as Prime Minister, had introduced double-entry bookkeeping into defence expenditure. What he said was essentially, instead of giving the Navy X million pounds a year to run itself, the Navy had to put a budget in which said we're going to spend this much on this item and this much. So a whole micromanager's list of tiny little pieces of business. And all the Navy could do was then spend the money it was awarded on those budget items. It wasn't allowed to transfer money from one item to another. If it saved money, it wasn't allowed to transfer that to another use. And if it overspent, it had to go back to Parliament and ask for more money. This was not efficient in terms of running a war-fighting organisation. It was effective in terms of imposing political control over naval expenditure. And it was that tool which Wellington introduced in 1827, which Graham then used as the basis of his reforms. So bookkeeping ends up changing the way the Navy is run. So the system that had defeated Napoleon and all comers only 15 years earlier was thrown away in pursuit of a short-term political agenda. At the same time, Graham and the Whig Party organised the recruitment of dockyard workers to ensure that all of the dockyard constituencies voted for the Liberals. They'd voted for the Tories for the previous 50 years. And this was profoundly controversial and led to serious problems at a succession of elections down to the 1850s. The naval vote was politicised because the Board of Admiralty was a political board, whereas the Navy Board was an apolitical board, and abolishing it brought politics into naval administration in a serious and very unfortunate way. So while it looked like a clever piece of business, it was in fact removing a barrier between political interference and naval efficiency. And naval efficiency did suffer.